Welcome to Popcast Deluxe, your Phoebe High-Low of weekly cultural review. I'm John Caramonica, critic of the New York Times.
Did you come up with that yourself?
Freestyled it.
Okay, that was good.
Thank you. I appreciate this.
Usually comment on your intros, but that one was particularly good.
So what you're saying is the previous 23 were not good.
But yeah, that was 223.
You are?
I'm Joe Coscarelli. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. Did you already say your part?
I said I'm John Garawanaga.
Okay.
This week, I feel like we got a hot one.
Yeah.
Yeah. Two main parts. We're going to talk about Priscilla, which is the new Sofia Coppola film about Priscilla Presley, both in Priscilla Presley's presence and perhaps also in her absence. There's a lot going on in this movie. We're going to get into that. Then, speaking of star-crossed lovers, we're going to talk about Golden Bachelor. We're just off hometowns. We're heading into the final stretch of Golden Bachelor.
We're at a cliffhanger.
We are at a cliffhanger.
The final three becoming the final two.
But we don't know who the two are, or we know one of the two. We got songs of the week. We got snacks. Let's talk about Priscilla, man.
Life of my own.
I did not know when I went into the theater that I was watching a movie about a groomer.
You didn't?
I sort of like knew. I didn't know.
Did you know she was going to be 14 when the movie started?
I knew she was young, but I guess I didn't know how heavily the movie would lean into that.
Oh yeah.
So like a groomer and then subsequently a hostage film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So that was quite a lot. I'm curious. Let's explain sort of the genesis of the film, first of all.
Okay, so I feel like where we have to start is with Baz Luhrmann's Elvis.
Yes. Yes.
We are the same, you and I. We are two odd, lonely children reaching for eternity.
Greatest show on earth.
That came out 2022.
I wish I had a cape. Like a thing.
Yeah.
Like a
Yeah. You're Vegas.
Absolutely. My suit. Favorite, as determined, my favorite city. Yeah, so Baz Luhrmann's Elvis came out.
Yeah, we're in a moment of turning over the Elvis estate for fresh content.
Sure.
And I do think it is crucial to note that Priscilla and her family, Lisa Marie, RIP, Priscilla's granddaughter, Riley Keough, the whole family team mm-hmm. has been involved in getting both of these movies off the ground in some way. And given their stamp of approval, but not in the same way. We'll talk about it.
To contrast, before you continue, I was really curious about the budgets of these films.
Yeah.
Elvis, Baz Luhrmann's film, $85 million. Frankly, for that content, a bargain. Cheap. Yeah. A bargain. This film, Sofia Coppola's Priscilla, $20
million. Right.
So if anything you want to know about these films, you can start with that piece of information, with those pieces of information. Then I'll tell you a lot right off rip.
I know Sofia Coppola recreated Graceland for hers, I think in Canada.
Recreated.
But I think the Gracelands in both films sort of match.
Yeah,
the living room.
There's just sort of it is like the cool gray version of Graceland.
Yes.
In Sofia film.
So Priscilla, which I didn't know, I went in pretty cold to the film.
Yes.
I learned from the opening credits that it is based on Elvis and Me.
A memoir.
Priscilla Presley's memoir from the mid-80s, about almost a decade after Elvis died. She wrote her tell-all. And we'll get into this, but I actually spent Sunday, the day after I saw the movie, just reading Elvis and Me, mm-hmm. cover to cover, which I didn't plan to do, but it sucked me in.
A lot of homework,
yeah. But it didn't feel like homework. It was both deep and upsetting and also a breeze, which I think matches my experience of this film. I thought it was much more of a straightforward biopic than I was expecting from a Sofia Coppola movie.
Don't things have to happen in a biopic?
Not if you're Priscilla Presley.
And maybe not if you're Sofia Coppola.
Okay, so just as we could talk about the Elvis part, but like, what is your relationship to Sofia Coppola and her
films? Always important to ask.
Yeah.
Virgin Suicides, yes.
Okay. Like at the time or recently?
At the time. Everything at the time.
Okay.
But no Marie Antoinette, no Bling Ring.
You've never seen them?
No, regrettably. And I feel like I would really like, certainly Bling Ring, I feel like I'd probably like.
Which is funny because I would like Bling Ring, but it's my least favorite of her movies.
Oh, interesting.
Because I think I'm attached to the source material.
Sure.
Let's just play the Alexis Nyers clip really quick.
She said I was wearing 6-inch Louboutins to court with my tweed outfit.
Nancy Jo, this is Alexis Nyers calling. I'm calling to let you know how disappointing.
Okay, what other ones besides those three?
Lost in Translation?
Yes. I don't like it as much as everybody else.
But you've seen it?
Yes.
Somewhere?
Twice. No.
Okay. The recent Apple movie?
No.
Bill Murray?
I was informed of it yesterday.
Doesn't count. To me, we're going to...
Not canon.
Yeah. We're going to get to a point where streaming movies are like mixtapes. They just don't count. And if you don't really want it to count against your legacy, you're like, oh, that was just a streaming movie.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, that was a mixtape. Like, just like, whatever.
That was just on Paramount.
If it's a streaming movie and it's fire, like Monster or 56 Nights, then it counts.
What was the CBS streaming service? CBS All Access? Like, nah, that was just CBS All Access. It doesn't count.
Yeah. Okay. So you've seen some Sofia Coppola.
I have, and I...
But not Marie Antoinette, which is probably the closest parallel.
Analog.
And part of the reason why I expected this to be a bit more abstract than it was.
Yes.
Is because of Marie Antoinette.
But he's also part of the reason that this wasn't more abstract is because literally every 45 seconds, another year passes in this film.
Sometimes more years in a minute.
Genuinely unbelievable timeline. Like, not unbelievable, but unbelievable timeline. I'm sorry. We just have to, let's just say this.
Go ahead.
I thought the writing was like by ChatGPT. It was unbearably bad. And it only served to be like pure, like most of the time, minimal emotional content, maximum expository content. Just how do we get in and out of this scene? I was stressed. You feel the budget constraints with the number of montages, with the number of tight shots as opposed to like big atmospheric shots and wide shots or dreamier stuff. You really feel the budget constraints, lack of sets, lack of, you know, there's not, most things are just like camera here and like us talking or me talking. I mean, it's like, it's podcast deluxe. Half of it's podcast deluxe. Do we get a $20 million budget?
Someday.
Yeah.
Okay. Here's what I'm going to say.
Also, the last thing, sorry.
Go ahead.
Here's the last thing.
Go ahead. Get it off
your guarantee, chest. I guarantee the first day this was out, our guy Austin Butler, like, snuck into a screening somewhere in wherever he is and, like, walked out and was like, not a stain on me. Like, I'm good.
Okay. Good Austin Butler, streets. Who played Elvis.
Good.
In the Elvis warrior. Biopic.
Yes.
This Elvis, Jacob Elordi, you're coming out, Butler, in a first round knockout.
It couldn't be more clear.
Ooh, this is a crazy take. We can talk about the movie itself.
Not a crazy look. Jacob Elordi, great skin, good hair, one haircut for 95% of the film. Baffling to me. Absolutely baffling to me.
This is not Elordi's fault.
Priscilla had more hairstyles in 3 minutes than he had in 90
minutes. You think
he
decided what his hair looked like in
the
movie?
Simply
you can't grade against him based on what the wardrobe department
did. Okay, this is what I'm saying. Do you remember earlier, I don't know if it was you or Pat, had the hoodie on the broom there?
Yeah.
That's Jacob Elordi, a broom with a hoodie.
6'5" broom.
A 6'5" broom with a hoodie. That's Jacob Elordi. Sorry, he's not doing work.
Oh my God. I'm going to say, I thought Austin Butler was phenomenal as Elvis.
And you thought...
Especially, let me finish. Especially in the performance scenes, the first scene of Butler hip shaking in Baz Luhrmann's Elvis.
Yeah.
When the girls are, it's like the girls are losing their, actually losing their minds. Mm-hmm. And his mom is like, oh my God, like what is happening? Everyone's just like, what is happening? Mm-hmm. He has like the eyeliner. I think he's wearing like the pink satin.
Killer.
Insane performance, like pure sexual explosion. Mm-hmm. It's like,
Id boys.
Killing it. But not Elvis. Not quite Elvis. Like, again, I think we talked about this, or maybe you talked about this on Elvis Popcast original, where it was like, it's more about the memory of Elvis than it is like about Elvis.
It's fine. It's Baz Luhrmann. That's what a Baz Luhrmann film is.
Okay. This is Euphoria Hive speaking, like one of our great young actors. Alordi, I know you and I, you can't do Euphoria either, which just makes sense.
One of our great young Twizzlers. Unbelievable.
He played this down. He played this cool.
What percent of this film was Jacob Elordi awake for? What percent?
Took a lot of sleeping pills. Yeah, like, Elvis. Dang. Okay. I thought
as Elordi good was as Butler.
Better than Butler. He was a human. Okay. Butler was good on stage. Elordi's Elvis is never on stage.
You know why you're like the Amazing Race? Because you're tripping. Unbelievable. I can't believe I woke up on a Monday to come here and have you tell me this.
Jacob Elordi played this Elvis, played human Elvis better than Butler did.
Literally every line that Jacob Elordi said could fit on one sheet of paper.
Okay, so here's the other way.
Do you agree, little one?
Is that your impression?
That's my impression of Jacob Elordi.
You know, the one
doing
time...
Doing an impression of Austin Butler, doing an impression of Elvis.
He underperformed so much. He was so restrained. The one time he really let it rip. Do you know a line I'm going to say?
I'm going to be a duddy.
Exactly. Exactly. But he's like... I can't even do it. He's like, you telling me I'm going to be a daddy?
A daddy.
It was incredible.
There's a great tweet. Man. I got to find this tweet. Did you see like the Lilo and Stitch tweet? You know what I'm talking about?
Where Jacob Elordi said in an interview that his entire knowledge of Elvis going into making this movie was from watching Lilo and Stitch. It's incredible, but you could feel that.
Austin Butler broke himself to prep for Elvis, all for Jacob Elordi to just watch Lilo and Stitch and eat Bacom. What's Bacom? I don't know what it is.
Bacon.
Oh, it's spelled with an M.
It's a typo.
It's a good typo, though.
It's a good typo. Yeah, Elordi said he ate a pound of bacon a day to prep for playing Elvis, which you couldn't tell from his figure.
No, this is the other thing. Okay, there's so many things that I found frustrating about this film. There is no, forgive the phrasing, there is no fat Elvis. There's no fat Elvis, period. And even in the last 10 to 15 minutes of the film where all of a sudden he finally gets a hairstyle.
Yeah.
And also the clothes are no longer like straight hem shirt. First of all, shout out Maison Valentino. Really did kill it with the straight hem shirt. I have no notes on the costumes.
Just the hairstyle.
Literally, I'm sorry.
What'd you think of the makeup? Was the cat eye by, to your liking, Elvis?
Black hair and more eye makeup.
I don't know if I like it.
What do you mean you don't know if you're lying? Yet?
You mean on Priscilla? Yeah, that's makeup is fine. Hairstyle, her hairstyle is fine.
Okay.
Like, I really felt like, okay, when I get on camera.
Sometimes.
When I get on camera, sometimes put a little something in the hair. You know, tighten it up, make sure it's not going to go all over the place. I felt like it was about that much attention to the hair in a $20 million film.
Elordi's
hair. Specific. All the hair budget went to Priscilla.
Okay.
As
it should be.
No, and which is fine. But like, I just, if you're looking at him, like 10 years are ostensibly passing, or 9 years are ostensibly passing. No, actually more. He barely changes at all.
Mm-hmm.
I never quite knew. And I understand like the sort of like ethereality of Sofia Coppola films. Like I understand, like, but I felt like a biopic that has such clear kind of like TikToks and things happening, I never quite knew where I was temporally, but I don't think it was in a like dreamlike way where all things melt together. I think it was like in a, there are not enough plot tent poles to really like orient myself via.
Okay. I want to say something specific and then I want to pull back. The specific thing I want to say is that you really did feel her growing up in the movie. The difference between once she has 70s hair versus when she was a kid.
We should say the actress who plays Priscilla, Kaylee Spaney, maybe first leading film role, like has been in some
other things. That's Erin McMenamin from Mare of Easttown for the Real Heads.
which I have not watched, but sounds great.
She's the dead girl. Not great. A spoiler. It's the plot device.
Fine. To me, I thought the playing of it, like, did a great job playing innocent and then awakening from innocence, but never fully awoken out of innocence. Like, even in the scenes which are ostensibly like the big climax when it's like, I'm done, there's still something sort of winningly naive about the portrayal at that point. And I feel like you're meant to understand that Priscilla is like leaving finally, like, sort of like a
spoiler. Elvis and Priscilla don't stay together.
If you've made it respectfully, I'll send an email. It's fine. But by the time she ups and leaves, there's still childlikeness in her.
Well, she was quite young.
Right. But what I was most struck by is actually the point in which I thought she felt the most like adult in the film was probably like 10 to 15 minutes earlier than that, when she's really dealing with the toughest parts of being with Elvis. That's when she seemed the most grown. And then when she's heading back out into the world, it's like getting, you know, pushed out of the womb.
Yeah.
And feeling new again.
But the friend who I saw the movie with actually turned to me and said, did they switch the actor? Because
for her.
Yeah. Because even though so much of the movie is tight on her face, like, they do a really good job of making her look 14 and then like a really good job of making her look in her 20s.
Yes.
The actress is in her mid 20s, which I thought was interesting also, which I wasn't sure about watching the movie. I was like, is this a teenager? But I got to pull back and blow your mind and go back to your statement about the writing of this film, because what I learned with the source material is that every single beat of the movie and every single line of dialogue is exactly from the book. They cut out a lot, but every line of dialogue is exactly as written in the memoir. There is no like conflation. There is no elaborating. There is nothing created for the film that is not in the memoir, which
and was a noble choice.
No. I was shocked by it. I was shocked by it. And I think
you mean this literally.
I mean it literally.
Like, you double checked it.
I read the book 12 hours after I saw the movie. Because this was my main thing. Yes. Everything is from the book. The script is entirely constructed from the book. And to me, I agree with you. I came out thinking, man, it was a little bit flat. Like, there was not literal. And it is because it is a very literal adaptation. But cutting out parts of the book that I thought really would have hit on film. Like, for instance, she finds out, I mean, obviously she knows the whole time it's Elvis, but she finds out that he is cheating on her pretty openly, like among her very first trips to hang out in Germany, when she's still a kid. Like, even the idea that she entered into the arrangement, not thinking that he was the perfect gentleman that he is portrayed. I thought that was an interesting choice in the movie to make him seem like even more of a gentleman in her mind than she felt in real life. So I thought that was an interesting omission. Like, there's stuff that is, it's not the whole book, crucially.
Do the facts line up? Like, other than that, do the facts basically line up?
Yes. So my main thought was like, man, did Elvis really take LSD? That was like my main fact check. And in fact, according to Priscilla's book, they took it exactly one time, just like in the book. The book burning of Autobiography of a Yogi. They literally burned his books. I thought that part in the film was great. This mid-60s moment where Elvis can go down one path or go down the other in terms of expanding his mind, following counterculture, or remaining the Elvis of the late 50s, early 60s. And you see him almost go there, and then he burns the books. And then I leaned over to my friend and I said, this is why the Beatles passed him. And then in the very next scene, he's like, don't you dare play the Beatles in my house. This is America. Sure. Mm-hmm. So there was like those moments I felt were strong Elvis wise. But yes, everything is from the book in a way that I agree. I thought it hamstrung the movie because of how faithful it was to the source material.
Also, the thing that I would say, and I just tell a brief story, of course, about Taylor Swift in this moment, because like, why else? Yeah. I remember someone told me when that song Enchanted came out, they were like, oh, that's like a specific sentence, like the sentence at the core of the hook is like drawn from a real life interaction.
I was enchanted to meet you.
Yes. And as if that was supposed to make the song good because it was drawn from a real life. And I, at that time I said that literally has nothing to do with the making of great art. And so even though I now know this detail, it, if anything, it stresses me out that nobody along the path was like, hey, maybe that worked in the memoir. I mean, I don't, and I haven't read the memoir. Maybe it did or didn't work, but that's got to be, we have to have a more than that skeletal frame to hang this film on. It's not enough to hang a film on. There's almost no, there's so little emotion in the lines and in the reading of the lines. I think you had to learn a lot about Elvis and Priscilla from the physical interactions between Jacob Elordi and Kaylee Spaney. Like that, you had to read a lot into that. You're not really getting it from the words. One thing I'm consistently struck by in this film, and there are a lot of jokes about the size difference between the two of them. Jacob Elordi's extremely tall. I don't think Elvis was that tall. I don't know if this, how, if the height difference was,
they were
was
much pronounced. Closer.
They're much closer.
They were much closer in height.
But I think, you know, as visual metaphor, it was actually quite beautiful that he's perpetually out of reach to her. Like he is quite literally unreachable to her. And I don't know if that's exactly what Sofia Coppola set out to achieve, but you really, in the scenes where the two of them are interacting, the fact that he is always here and she, it's almost like she's like a, literally like a kid, like pulling on his pant leg, like, yeah. Hey, pay attention to me, pay attention
Which
to
apparently
me.
Apparently is the way he wanted it yes. to be, considering he sent a friend to pluck a 14-year-old from a army base diner.
There's been a lot of conversation about the fact there's no Elvis music in this film mm-hmm. or extremely minimal Elvis music.
And a lot of anachronistic music in general,
yes.
which is a Sofia Coppola thing.
Which, and I like that. And I think also, and a lot of people have noted this, it makes the film very firmly not about Elvis.
Right.
And her relationship is, by and large, not with Elvis the celebrity, at least not in the film. It's with Elvis behind closed doors. The thing that I'm most struck by, and I wonder maybe about the memoir, this kind of persistent behind closed doors intimacy, him wanting to continually like keep her and infantilize her. That's all there.
Oh yeah. Oh boy. Is it there? Can I read you
yeah.
a couple selections
every week on Podcast Deluxe? Joe will read an excerpt from a seminal text.
So you remember the montage in the movie where they just stay in the bedroom and it shows the meals being yes. delivered to the door. Yes. So this is the part in Priscilla's memoir where she's talking about that. There were times when we'd shut ourselves off from the world for days. Elvis would leave word that he wanted, quote, no calls unless it's my daddy, an emergency call from the colonel, which
yeah.
again, exact line from the
yeah.
movie. It was my time and no one could interfere. We were hungry. We would phone down to the kitchen, order our food, which was brought up and placed outside our bedroom door. We saw no one nor even the light of day. I'm skipping ahead. We always seemed to be more in love when we were alone. I loved those times when he was just Elvis, not trying to live up to an image or a myth. We were two people discovering each other. Only in the privacy of our own quarters did Elvis show me a side of himself, which had rarely, if ever, been seen by others. No colonel, no scripts, no films or music, nor other people's problems. Elvis could become a little boy again, escaping from the responsibilities of his family, friends, the press, and the world. Here with me, he could be vulnerable and childlike, a playful boy who stayed in his pajamas for days at a time. Like, that's, to me, like, that was accurately rendered onto the screen. And those parts sort of in between moments, not again, I agree, the dialogue stilted. You didn't yeah. find much about them or what their connection was. But she writes that and she's basically like, I was his doll. He loved me because he could make me do and say whatever he wanted. In fact, it's much stricter and more authoritarian
in the book.
You know, she's basically like, he didn't like aggressive women. He didn't like ambitious women. He liked quiet, small brunettes that he could have at his beck and call whenever he wanted, you know? And it's like, that is like that, the intensity of, you called it grooming, which like mm-hmm. quite literally
yeah.
grooming. And the way she juxtaposed that in the film, to me, the most successful moment and actually the most Sofia Coppola moment, which I wish there was a little more of, is the scene where he takes her shopping It's a Kanye Kim moment where he's basically like, this is what you're going to wear. These are the colors you can wear. These are the colors I like. This is how I want your hair. This is how I want your makeup.
Solid colors, no prints. Jamie, you could not wear the shirts. Jamie, no shirt, no Jamie shirts.
No loud pattern shirts. Yeah. He hates a pattern. And all that very literally in the book. But then immediately after the most controlling, that's like the first real peak of like, darkness, other than the fact that he met her when she was 14.
Other than the entire movie.
Yeah. And then it immediately goes to the montage of them doing bumper cars, shooting fireworks, having like the best time in the world. And like that real, like that juxtaposition to me, it really worked in the sense of like, here's the darkness and the light all at once.
I really wish I could remember which review this was brought up in. I think it might have been Anthony Lane's review, but I'm not totally sure. But I thought the film did a really good job of infantilizing Elvis.
Yes.
And that is a really striking choice, especially in the wake of the Baz Luhrmann film. And obviously in the Baz Luhrmann film, Elvis is kind of at the whims of Colonel Tom. Like, he is a child, but he is the star. He's the alpha, even if he's the alpha that's being kind of like puppeteered a little bit. It's striking in this movie to see Elvis. You see him small, you see him human scale, but you also see him childlike. And the conversation about the grooming in this film or in real life, like obviously that's its own set of concerns. But in moments when you're looking at Elvis and Priscilla in this film, you're looking at two children. And that's, I think, if I had to guess what the intent was, it's to show that there is something, I mean, pure is not the right word, but that there is something like mutually naive about the way that they are falling for each other.
She also writes quite beautifully about the fact that she thinks he was drawn to her because he had so many problems and she had none, basically. Mm-hmm. Like, she came from a good family, again, except
for the part where you
where they hand her daughter, where they hand her over. Daughter on a plane. Yeah, I mean,
also another good spot. We haven't talked a lot. Go ahead.
No.
We haven't talked as much about Kaylee's performance. There's a really great scene when she returns from Memphis from the first trip and meets her family at the airport. And she's incredibly well put together in like what I would imagine are meant to be pricey clothes. But everything from the neck up is completely in disarray. The hair, the makeup.
She spent the whole flight crying.
Yeah.
Her hair's.
Everything's just tossed in 100 directions. But actually the outfit's very put together. And I thought she carried that moment in the film. Like, there's a comedic stretch and a comedic point in that scene, which I thought was great.
I mean, her face acting.
That's, I mean, most tier. Of the, yes. I mean, most of the acting is face acting.
Watching her develop her crush on him, watching her sort of like have a fire lit within her, watching him perform when he catches the glass falling off the piano. Again, detail straight from the book. Mm-hmm. Like everything, like I cannot overstate how literal the adaptation is.
And,
but being able to carry all of that in a close up of one young woman's face is like quite impressive.
And actually, I mean, I wonder on some level if, like, you know, Jacob Elordi's face is not that expressive, but this is, look, it's a Sofia Coppola film. It's about a young, what, I mean, these are Sofia Coppola films. I'm not surprised that the better face acting, that the better role is essentially for the young woman who is trying to learn / force her way into adulthood via some potentially unsavory paths.
All right, I got another related two subtakes that are related that I want to hit you with.
Yeah.
One of the great Entourage movies of all time. Priscilla. This movie is not about Priscilla Presley. This movie is about
those seven guys.
It is about being on the outer edge of an entourage. And this is the related take. Elvis, she made Elvis a rapper. All he does is hang out with his friends, buy stuff, play with guns, drive fast, and smoke. Like, she presents him, and I was shocked to realize this was not a modern anachronistic affectation. Like, this is, again, from the book. And, like, it is about...
Maybe rappers are just copying
Elvis. That's what I'm saying. Yeah. Rappers are... Like, I was like, oh, Elvis she made Elvis into a rapper. And now I'm like, oh, no, every rapper Elvis just wants to be Elvis. But even the fact that... Even the fact that none of the entourage is known to her, like she never has any individual interactions mm-hmm. with them. They're just like a blob of dudes who are there at all times, taking away his attention from her.
Like when she says she's pregnant, they're there. Like literally at the most, I'm surprised they're not in the room when the food's being delivered.
I mean, they basically are. That's why she was so desperate for those times. That was the only time she had with him, because Graceland especially was just like, free for all for him and his friends. And I really thought the move, like when they close down the skating rink and they're like roughhousing mm-hmm. skating and she's like sitting on the outside eating fries and he just like pops in mm-hmm. and takes one of her fries. Like, to me, that's the,
do you think that's the skating rink I went to with Moneybag Yo in Memphis?
It could have been.
I wonder. I guess we'll know, but.
Yeah, so I thought the portrayal of the entourage was like incredible.
I don't know if I thought it was incredible. I mean, it was funny, but it's like what were their names?
That's the one. The only one that gets a name is Joe.
Joe. There's another one maybe named Jerry.
I don't know. Only Joe.
I happened to see a screening that was a captioned screening.
Okay.
Like not by design. Happened to be one. And I, at a certain point, I swear it said like man 12
or like that's man 15. That's what I'm saying. I had an interesting viewing experience also, which is I saw the movie next to what seemed to be a mother and daughter, much older, who were Elvis super fans.
Okay, both.
They were just trading trivia. I mean, they talked through the whole movie, but luckily it was amusing.
Yeah, sure.
Like when she goes up to his bedroom the first time and you see the shot of his nightstand and there's a black and white photo on it. And one woman leans over to the other and she goes, "That's Gladys," meaning Elvis's mom.
Wow. Okay.
Like, and then they're like, "Oh, like she died in," and they're like naming, they're like just sharing all the trivia. And like they were watching it as Elvis fans, which made me realize that only in the last 18 months or 2 years has Elvis been at all a part of my pop cultural life.
Yeah.
And it took this push seemingly from the family and the estate and these two films and whatever's been re-released in tandem or in the meantime to really make me aware of Elvis beyond just being an icon in the purest sense sure. of the word. I'm grateful for it. Mm-hmm. I am. Like, I love the mythology.
Yeah, and also, I you know, obviously history tends to paint him as a uncomplicated. Yes. His legacy has been sandpapered.
Yes.
And it is a far more complicated legacy. There's a lot more happening positively and negatively. And so it's to have the opportunity to re-engage with that, obviously, is really helpful.
Yeah, and it is interesting the way that his legacy is divided in these two films because Baz Luhrmann's version is told through the eyes of Colonel Tom Parker, his Svengali manager. Mm-hmm. And there's basically no Priscilla in that movie.
Yeah.
And this movie is told obviously through the eyes of Priscilla and there's no Tom Parker. He's also not seen on screen. He's only right. exists on the other side of the phone. Mm-hmm. And I thought I liked the way those things could complement each mm-hmm. other. And I also am awaiting the supercut where somebody combines the Baz Luhrmann version and the Sofia Coppola version to be one Scorsese length film.
There's a cease and desist awaiting whoever does yes. this at the best level. Did you see the thing where Lisa Marie, before she passed, had sent an email to Sofia Coppola being like, "Don't do this"?
She said no. But her mom was into it?
Her mom, yeah, because obviously there's tension between Lisa Marie and mom, and then obviously Riley. So she had sent an email essentially being like, "We're just coming off of this big Elvis Baz Luhrmann thing, really restores some color mm-hmm. and some honor to grandpa's legacy. I've got kids. I don't want to have them to face a new cycle of all the things that their grandfather did that weren't so savory. Why are you doing this? You also come from a famous family. You understand you understand what the pressures are like.
She hit her with that card.
She hit her with that card. Yeah. She hit her with the Nepo to Nepo card, like really went in. And then Coppola's response is like very measured and like, please reserve judgment. You'll find that we took it more seriously. I was left wondering who leaked those emails. I feel like maybe Coppola's team leaked those emails because the sort of kicker in the story about it is like a few pages were trimmed from the script that like maybe softened or sensitized around Elvis's character. So I wonder if it was leaked maybe as a way to sort of like stir up a little bit of controversy, but then to say, oh no, the filmmakers actually did a good thing.
Here's my question for you. I don't think either of us necessarily see films like this in moral terms, but did you find this movie to be damning against Elvis?
No.
Even in the sense that it pretty straightforwardly painted the grooming of a 14-year-old.
Obvious. That's like my main takeaway is that, but I felt like I said in Sofia Coppola's choice to essentially infantilize Elvis and to keep the innocence in the portrayal of Priscilla. I think what she was getting at was not, I think if she wanted to make a film that was damning about the power dynamic and all this stuff, the texture of it and the tone of it would have been very different. I don't get the sense that that's what she wanted. I think she wanted to almost like rescue them from the specifics of their circumstance and enter them into some kind of like dreamlike state, very consistent with some of her other films. That's how it felt to me.
I thought that as well, again, until I read the memoir, which while considering all that Elvis did to terrorize and control her, ultimately comes down on the note of him being the most influential person in her life, sure, her mentor, the person who raised her, for better or worse, and also paints him as withholding sexually as he's painted in the movie. Yeah. And I did have the thought reading it, did she pull punches here?
In the memoir
yeah, to protect his legacy? There's one specific line that feels very, very lawyered, where it's like, nothing he ever did made me feel unsafe. Or like, yeah, very, it's the end of a chapter. It's the kicker of a chapter. And yet, she also goes in and talks more in the book about sexual proclivities. And specifically, another thing that I thought was Sofia Coppola doing an anachronistic thing, there's the montage in the bedroom portion.
Oh, with the end.
It's the Instagram montage, where they're taking Polaroids of each other, yes, and selfies. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, this is very Sofia Coppola to be, yes, like, even, you know, to, again, I was thinking like, this is Cardi B and Offset, yeah, you know? Mm-hmm. And she's making the point that
Sofia Coppola doesn't know who Cardi B and Offset.
Just let me know. That was in the book. The thing about
Cardi B and Offset.
She was basically like, Priscilla says, you know, if this is too hot for Popcast Deluxe, you know, mute this if you're in the car with your kids. She was like, in lieu of intercourse, like what he was into was like role play and like and taking photos of me. And she's like, I would put on dark sunglasses. I would go to the store. I would buy a bunch of Polaroid film and I would come home and like put on a maid costume. And like, that was our thing. And I was scandalized, but I could not believe that it came from history, and not from the film itself.
Maybe this is a good time to pivot to another visual document that made me wonder about the morality of capturing certain kinds of relationships on film.
You want to talk about Jerry?
Boy,
Jerry.
Boy, do I. It's Golden Bachelor time.
It is Golden Bachelor time.
Stop looking for the woman that you can live with. And start looking for the woman that you just can't live without.
Your
the last time that someone said those things to me, it was my wife of 43 years. I never thought I would see it again. And I'm seeing it and feeling it with more than one person.
We don't have to explain the Bachelor universe.
Explain the Bachelor universe.
Okay, so...
Try to sell someone a podcast deluxe listener who does not engage with the Bachelor universe.
But I don't really care about the rest of the Bachelor universe anymore.
I agree. And that's why the Golden Bachelor is so special.
I agree.
Just set a little bit of foundation.
Okay. One titular character, the Bachelor or the Bachelorette, 25 suitors trying to claim their affections, participating in contrivances and challenges and whisper campaigns against each other.
Also known as dating.
Not where I stand. I don't know what kind of life you're living, but I don't know where I stand. And eventually on each season, someone theoretically gets engaged. Doesn't always happen.
Usually it does.
Usually happens. And then there are spinoff shows. There's Bachelor in Paradise, which truly seems vile.
Bachelor in Paradise is Love Island America.
It's unreal. I've watched a little bit now. I don't know where any of these people are.
Yeah, we both tapped out of the Bachelor universe
about
a handful of years ago.
6 years ago, yeah. 7 years ago. I didn't like how self-referential it was becoming. Similar to Survivor, where I'm just like, everybody's like, knows. Everybody knows what they're there for, and they're playing their roles. Which is, to your point, why Golden Bachelor is so refreshing. You had women on the show who had not apparently ever seen The Bachelor in any iteration before.
We haven't said what the twist of Golden Bachelor is, other than it being golden.
It's golden. Everybody is 16
60
over,
plus.
16 over. Not 55 and over. 16
and
over.
And Jerry, the Bachelor,
yes,
is 75.
I thought 72.
Sure.
But sure. It's got a hearing
over
aid.
Over 70.
Got a hearing aid. Lost his wife a few years ago. I don't know what kind of psychological evaluations people have to submit themselves to before they go on shows like this.
This is also what you were worried about when we talked about Survivor a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. But whatever psychological evaluation Gary was subjected to was insufficient because I love him. He's great. But the wellspring of trauma that he is being asked to access day in, day out, week in, week out, with all these different potential partners. I mean, we see him break down this past week.
That.
Yeah. The fragility that he displays is so disarming, so destabilizing to watch. Our colleague Amanda Hess wrote a piece a couple weeks ago, part of which talked about frankly how the end of life hovers over this show. It's startling to hear Gary continually say something about meeting someone to spend the rest of my days with. Like, I've been to two and a half weddings in the last, like, 10 days or 2 weeks. Nobody used that language, even though that's what a wedding is.
Right.
That's what a wedding is.
Yeah.
It's a partner for life.
Yeah.
But no one used that language.
Yeah.
This language hits extremely different coming from someone in their 70s, dating people in their 60s and 70s. Yeah. It's
you're shaken up, but I was also shaken up. In addition to binging the Priscilla Presley memoir this weekend, I watched all of Golden Bachelor straight through.
I would love to binge just watching you watch Golden Bachelor.
I cried a little bit.
Yeah.
This show is about mourning.
Yeah.
This is a show about mourning.
Yeah.
And it's a show that actually recast all of the desperation of the Bachelor universe. To me, it gave, like, seeing
it gives desperation meaning.
Yes. Seeing these people who have been left behind by
not everyone's
the
a widow
world
or
and
a widower.
Society. Yeah. No, no, no. But just like that,
the elderly can seem forgotten.
Yes.
Forgotten
and
in
they
popular
feel,
culture.
They feel that. Like,
yeah.
Watching some of these women say, like, you know, I haven't felt affection
in a decade,
or whatever, like, and seeing the fact that the show provides them an opportunity in a fixed circumstance to find something that might not otherwise be available to them, even with online dating or whatever it is, which is a hurdle for anyone, let alone somebody in their 60s or 70s. Like, it somehow allows The Bachelor to recast itself as a service to humanity.
A beacon of hope.
A beacon of hope. And I think that that is in part why they picked the person that they did to be The Bachelor, Jerry, who is the best person. Gary spelled Jerry. Sorry, it is spelled G-E-R-R-Y.
I'd love to have like a deep dive podcast episode about that particular spelling.
About why Gary's name is spelled Jerry.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jerry is, like, as I said, a true saint. They don't show a single moment of him breaking from being the best guy on earth.
He has four daughters.
And the women.
Like, literally, like, a father of daughters. Like, all the memes.
Oh, yeah.
A father of daughters, I mean, in the most literal sense.
And the women are like, you are the greatest person to ever walk the planet. Like, they are blown away by his emotional intelligence. The way that he.
Is it emotional intelligence or is it emotional generosity?
Maybe
I don't know if it's all respect to my guy. I don't know if it's emotional intelligence. I think it's emotional generosity and availability and a direct connection. Look, you don't want to presume how any one individual relates to the traumas that they've been through. I certainly, like, my own traumas, like, have affected me in unanticipated ways and in unexpected time frames. But the fact that he still seems close enough to the root of his trauma, it's processed enough for him to talk about, but not processed enough for him to not be unexpectedly caught off guard by the pain. And the fact that he makes all of that seemingly, at least in the clips we see, we know how edited these shows are.
I was going to say.
But the fact that he makes this available, not just to one person, but to multiple people, that's quite remarkable. If there's anything that he's doing that I feel a little itchy about, it's telling multiple people that they remind him of his late wife or the nature of their conversations. Like, that's the only moment
where I'm like, this guy's only frame of reference.
No, I know, but that's the only moment where I'm like, this is a little bit like, what are we doing here?
Yeah.
But in general, just the fact that he's able to access that, maybe that is it's not unintelligent. Like, but to me, it's more about the generosity than the kind of like specifics of the intelligence.
I did find myself wondering, you know, peeling back to the meta level, which is like, how much of Gary being an asshole did they have to cut around to present him in this light? And it really reminded me of another show from this year that also turns on the fact that its main character is the nicest guy of all time, Jury Duty. I don't think you saw it.
I haven't seen it, but that's.
Yeah. But it is it's a reality television show-ish with a twist that relies on the audience surrogate being unimpeachable as a human and literally being a white man who
is beyond reproach.
Who is beyond reproach. And I do think that there is, like, we are in a moment of that. It's the Ted Lasso thing. I don't watch Ted Lasso, but I know that that's the thing.
That's how I feel about most of the things you talk about. I'm like, I don't watch it, but I know what it's about. Let's like, honestly, round of applause for the casting directors.
Like, I mean, the women, we haven't said enough about
that. No, I know, but I was about to say, like, obviously, like, Gary on his own, like, it's almost as if there is no golden, like, you can't do this show if you don't have that person.
Yes.
And I'm
especially
not saying
that, first. Like, you, yes, could get a, first. You could get a, he's mean no old guy next.
Right. But also, it's like, he's not Alex Michelle.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Real ones, no. Like, he's not Alex Michelle. Like, this is, you have to start here.
Yes.
You have to start with this person who is vibrant, emotionally aware, raw, freshly wounded, sympathetic,
handsome.
Sure.
This guy looks unbelievable.
First of all, I gotta ask, I don't know the answer to this. If you work on the Golden Bachelor, I would like to know, what percent of his clothing is his and what percent is wardrobe? And do you have him in like some low-key Laura Piana? I would like to know.
Because he's dripping. If it's JCPenney, he's rocking it like it's Laura Piana.
Absolutely. He's really killing it. The range of women. so impressive.
So impressive.
Such a wonderful blend of personalities. And also, even when there is friction, and it's like, it's sort of part and parcel of the Bachelor universe, like there's always going to be tension between people who are competing for the affections of the same person. But even the tension between
Teresa, who is in the final three.
Yes. And possibly in the final two. We don't know yet. And Kathy. It's not that the stakes of that tension, it's not that that tension is not authentic, but I tended to see that tension less of two people fighting for the affections of one individual and more two women who have learned to navigate the world using a set of tools, each with their own set of tools, and those tools not being compatible. Also, just the fact of living together. Like, I haven't had a roommate since I was like 20 or 21. The idea that after marriage, after children, after grandchildren, that you voluntarily get up. Sandra missed her daughter's
wedding.
Respectfully.
I know.
Look, Sandra, A plus. Foul mouth. Love it.
Incredible. But speaking of somebody who looks insane for their age.
Great. Sandra.
Like.
Absolutely. But I don't know if I would have skipped the daughter's wedding, respectfully. Yeah. Respectfully. But
that's an insane thing to do. Yeah. I was like, this must be a second marriage.
Oh, we gotta do the research. That's a good thought. Wow, good call. Hadn't thought about that. But these are people who are, and I don't mean to say that they are fixed in their ways. It's not that they are fixed in their ways.
No, it's the opposite.
It's that they have lived so much and lived rich and varied lives that allow for the opportunity for an unexpected jolt of joy or pain, TBD.
This is a huge innovation in reality television to me. It is genuinely groundbreaking because it largely undoes everything that makes reality TV rotten, which again is often why we watch, but it takes away the thirst for fame. None of these people feel like they're there to get famous. Do you disagree?
I don't know if they're there to get famous, but I wonder what the next 6 months will be like.
I think some stuff could come to them, but it does not feel like the point. It feels like, to use Bachelor parlance, they're all there for the right reasons. And then it also, like you're saying, it takes away the friction. I thought going in, I was like, exactly what you're saying. These women are going to be so set in their ways that they are going to clash and be so hard-headed with one another. They are so amenable.
But this is...
They love each other.
But this is also...
And they root for each other.
Okay, forgive me for underscoring our age difference for a minute. I think I, at my age, am a... I hope. A more forgiving and generous person than I was 10 or 20 years ago, having lived through more things, having experienced more highs and more lows, having found a way through life that works for me, but understanding that that way of life may not work for everybody else. I think I'm generally like more empathetic and sympathetic. And I think what you see in these women is the sense that everybody in that house has lived through a trauma, has lived through a joy. They've lived through the loss of a spouse, whether through death or divorce. I'm sure there's other things that, and rather than see those as like points of weakness to kind of like poke at, I think there's a sense of collective trauma in that house. And because of that sense of collective trauma, everybody feels, I don't know if at peace is exactly the right word, but no one's putting on airs. Well, maybe not no one. There is the Teresa and Kathy thing, tough to say. But broadly speaking, no one is putting on airs. Everybody is coming with a bit of humility. Life has thrown them, frankly, a bit of a curveball. They're in their 60s or 70s. They're on a freaking dating show on ABC. Yeah. That's a curveball.
It's crazy.
And everybody is sort of broadly sympathetic to everybody else because they all literally, it's whether they're there for the right reasons, they're there for the same reason. And they have a similar backstory. And nobody appears to be out. I mean, I can't, when the podcasts get a hold of this and we find out all the tea,
like, I know.
I'm a little stressed about that.
I know. It is either a
feat. We're being worked.
I was going to say, it's either a feat of humanity, and this is like the most beautiful thing ever, or like,
we're absolutely being
worked. Or they're like, we are going to manipulate John and Joe.
Specifically John and Joe.
And like, honestly, kudos either way. Cause like this show, like they pulled it off. I did not think they would be able to pull this off. Like they pulled it off and they made it seem not only entertaining, but like valuable, which like I haven't thought that about The Bachelor ever, certainly in the last decade. Just quickly before we go.
Yeah.
You want to run down the three final contestants and a prediction for how this is all going to play out. So we got Leslie, who is
a fitness instructor slash dancer who dated Prince.
Who says that Sexy Dancer by Prince is about her. Cannot confirm or deny.
I know. I feel like all the Prince fans out there, someone, there's got to be like a Prince fan side. Like I got to call Murph or somebody and be like, what's the vibe on this?
And then the third woman is Teresa.
Who had the friction with Kathy.
Because she couldn't stop talking about how strong her connection was.
And which is, again, it's not an uncommon trope on The Bachelor or shows like this, that one person really wants to let everybody know how strong their connection is. But that what I've noticed with people of this age, there's something a little bit more sacred. It's like, I actually would like to hold
this. Respectful of one
another. Yeah. And I do think some of Teresa's commentary does feel a little bit
braggy.
Yeah, and like insensitive to how other people move. I think most of what we were talking about is there is a mutual sensitivity amongst everybody else, but there is a seems to be maybe an anxiety underlying how she moves the space talking about what's happening with her and Gary.
Who's he going to pick? Smart money's on Faith.
Faith.
Smart money's on the horse.
I was going to say Faith. I think it's Faith. I don't think it's Teresa. I think it's Faith or Leslie.
He also said he loved two of them and not Teresa.
Yeah. I mean, that's the other thing. It's like, look, when, you know, like a 27-year-old with like washboard abs and like thin eyebrows and a buzz cut says that, I'm just like, you know, that's fine. You're a little bit of a D-bag. It is what it is. When Gary's out here doing it, I'm like, bro, chill. Like, it's, you know, I'm stressed about the physical and mental health of the people on the show, Gary included. No, honestly.
All right. I just got to get this down then. This is my wild card prediction.
You think he's bringing someone back?
You remember Joan? Joan was the severe blonde woman who left because her daughter had a complicated
birth. Yeah.
That was the real match for Gary.
You think?
That was Gary's. They were the sparks.
That's a real one. That's a real
out of control. Mm-hmm. And she left very early.
Like episode two.
Yeah. To take care of her family.
Mm-hmm. Daughter had a child.
A tough birth. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know if we've seen the end of Joan. Just
that's where you're. Wow. Just interesting. The only thing I'll say to that, I like that as an idea, but Gary is a man of such integrity that even if that happens, I think he's sticking with Faith.
All right. We'll see.
You got some songs this week?
I got a song.
Okay. You first or me?
I'll go.
Go in.
Brent Faiyaz.
Sure.
I don't really like this guy. I don't love this guy. He's fine. He's a R&B singer from Maryland.
Yeah.
He's had some good songs. Crew.
Solid B.
Crew is a...
Crew's a...
It's a classic hook.
Yes.
It's a classic hook.
Yes. Who's on there?
Right? Goldlink.
Goldlink.
And Shag Lizzy.
Yeah. Great team up.
Incredible song. He put out an album last year, Wasteland.
Yeah, I think I reviewed that. Or was that 2 years ago? I feel like I reviewed that record. My struggle with Brent Faiyaz is I feel like I am consistently being told he's a serious artist making concept albums. And then every time I listen to the album, I'm just like, no, you're just making like sleazy R&B record. And that's fine. Lean into don't advertise it as something it's not. It's okay. Like just that alone is fine.
I agree. And that's why I'm coming to this project, which like we said about Shroom Movies, it's framed as a mixtape.
Yes.
It's independent. It's called Larger Than Life. Is it a concept album? Who knows?
Yeah.
There's a song on here called Upset.
Okay.
Featuring Tommy Richman.
Great.
And Felix with an exclamation point.
Okay.
Produced by a guy called Manny Valley, these are Maryland people. Okay. Kept this pretty local.
Okay.
There's a lot of features from local up and comers in his scene, in his city on here. And yeah, when you just need a sleazy R&B record, this song Upset scratched the itch. Don't care if I'm in the room.
I'm going to go in a different direction, a distinctly unsleazy record. You mess with Cody Johnson at all?
I don't know Cody Johnson.
So Cody Johnson from Texas, a very traditional country singer, sort of like even coming out when he, so Cody Johnson was the type of guy who could sell out like 40,000 seats before in Texas, before anybody like in Florida or Maryland or New York knew about him. Real stoic, real like spiritually tough, not tough, tough, spiritually tough, strong shoulders. I liked a lot of his independent records. He signed to major, I think he's on Warner, maybe two albums ago. And with all folks who make that switch, like obviously my stress is just like, ah, you're making like dumb, dumb records, like, you know, Trucks and Girls records. And Cody Johnson, like to his credit, stayed the course. Maybe they're like a tiny bit slicker, tiny bit more refined. But on a fundamental level, these are pure neo-traditionalist records. He has a, I would say, let's call it a B-plus voice. It's interesting. It's interesting, but it's not amazing. Rude. Yeah, sorry.
Facts,
but rude. It's not an amazing voice. He's not going to blow you away with the power of the vocal, but the certainty of the vocal and the color and texture of the vocal, I think, are really, really lovely. He's really committed to the sound of the voice. So he's got a new record. It's an incredible title. It's called Leather.
Wow.
Like, truly go off. Like, when I saw that, I was like, oh, this is about to be a classic. So the song I'm going to play is the title track. The album just came out.
The album and the song are both called Leather?
I mean, it's like, what else can you really say? Also, because of my car's been in the shop and I've had satellite radio in the rental, they've been playing his first single from this album, which I think I maybe put in playlist or something. It's called The Painter, which is like a very, very beautiful, like serious, kind of like serious side of Alan Jackson love song about how like love doesn't come alive until like you're the painter. Go off, Cody. You know what you're doing. This is Leather, though.
You can bend him, but you can't break him. It takes years of work and dirt and hurt to make him. When the whole world falls apart, he'll hold together. That's how you know that a cowboy's made of leather.
Snack time.
Oh, yeah, let's do it.
Let's get it.
We got something special today. Imports.
Imports.
These are from Social Guru.
So Fast, So Furious. Import scene. Pat Gunther.
These are...
That went to...
Portugal?
Portugal.
These are Wild Strawberry gummies.
I asked Pat, so this company is a... He said it's like a Haribo type. I didn't know if it was like a store, like a Walmart, or the maker of the candy. But since it's a...
Vidal. It's a Spanish gummy.
Yes, company. Spanish gummies.
Yeah. Imported via the UK. Great. So you're going to start out with the wild strawberries. I've got the sour mix. These look like they're watermelon slices, wild strawberries, and kiwi slices. All right.
Look at the
kiwi gummy.
That's
you don't get those in America.
No, it's, I mean, gummy. I feel like you get in maybe some Asian gummies.
Yeah, sure.
Okay, let's talk about verisimilitude first.
You like that?
Good texture, great color, bold color.
Oh, whoa, we got a cola in a with stray, the fruit.
A stray? Yo, call quality control.
I know, the cola's on the box, but I just wasn't expecting it. A sour cola in with the kiwi. I'm going for the kiwi, though.
Okay. So this is interesting for a couple reasons. The face is a much thinner gummy than the base. Mm-hmm. So it's a two-tiered gummy. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's two things happening here.
Two greens and two reds.
No, well, just the texture. It's more like one solid texture on the base and then one thinner texture on the face. Okay. That they're agnostic to the color that they share. I like to chew. I'm not sure the flavor's really doing it for me.
These have some flavor. So I did the kiwi and the watermelon.
Why is cola in the mix with kiwi, watermelon? And
mixed up.
Is this also a strawberry?
Yeah, there's a strawberry in there too.
The cola flavor is really interesting.
Do you eat sour colas in general?
Like I a Haribo? But I don't really love them.
Yeah.
I like those.
Better? Better than a normal cola?
Yes. Yeah. And yeah, it's more colorful flavor.
Here's what I will say. Hot candy take. I do not like artificial strawberry flavor.
As a gateway fruit flavor, that's like, you know, strawberry is my entry point.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. We have quite different tastes in gummies, specifically.
I feel like the watermelon is good. You feel what I'm saying about the two-tier thing? Mm-hmm. You almost have to eat it face first, like a little baby.
These are flavorless, though. These don't taste
like anything. That's what I'm saying.
I like the sour a lot. I give the sour probably like an 8 out of 10. I do not like the strawberries one bit. It's probably like a 3.5 out of 10 for me.
What about his chewing experience?
Yeah, but it's too jelly-like.
In the front?
Both, the combo.
Interesting.
I just don't, got no use for those.
The point of it is the chewing. The point of it is prolong the chewing experience. In essence, it's offering you a distraction more than it's offering you a snack.
It's not what I'm here for.
No, I agree. I'm going to go 4 on the strawberries. I think these are lovely.
Yeah.
I think like 4 out of 4. Well, 3 out of 4. The strawberry one's not quite as good as the other ones. I'm going to go 7 on this. If you're ever in Spain or anywhere else on the Iberian Peninsula,
check these out.
Hit these. That's our show. I hit the sourness I'm getting now, to be honest.
Those are as sour as a cupcake.
All right. Every Popcast Deluxe ever, like and subscribe. YouTube.com/Popcast. We'll be here every week. Every Popcast across audio and video is at nytimes.com/podcast. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com, with any questions, comments, thoughts, or asides. We'll probably get to them in a subsequent mailbag episode. tinyurl.com/podcast Discord or Popcast Facebook. That's for the Facebook group and the Discord. And subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get audio or audio visual content. It's Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or anywhere else. Our senior producer is Sawyer Roque. Our editor is Jamie Heffetz. In the room today is Pat Gunther. Thank you to Karen Gans, Pedro Rosado, Leslie Davis, Nell Gologli. We'll be back next week.